You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiya. When you think of the word empire, what comes to mind? The Roman Empire, the Empire State Building, the United States? But hold on a minute, you might say, isn't America a republic? Aren't empires ruled by emperors or Caesars, not elected representatives? Well, according to Neil Ferguson, the Scottish historian, author, and Harvard professor, the U.S. is an empire, in denial. He says we're actually the real thing, but we pretend to ourselves that we're not because, well, empires are evil, and we're, of course, good.
The United States continues to insist that when it invades Afghanistan or when it invades Iraq, it's not an empire. It's just that the rest of the world can't take this claim seriously.
Naturally, Neil's gotten into a lot of flack for saying this. We're here in his office at Harvard University. Neil Ferguson, welcome to ThoughtCast.
It's nice to be here, Jenny.
Neil, in your book Colossus, The Price of America's Empire, you argue that the U.S. is indeed an empire, whether we like it or not, and that we'd better start acting like one. But how can we be an empire that's not acting like one at the same time?
Well, I think the first point to clear up is whether it's possible for a republic or indeed a democracy to be an empire. And clearly it is, because after all, the Dutch Republic was a very successful empire in the 17th and 18th centuries, establishing Dutch rule in East Asia and elsewhere. And the British Empire, which was probably geographically the biggest empire of all time, was a fully fledged democracy at its maximum territorial extent in the 1930s. So the interesting thing about it is, as you say, that terminologically Americans are allergic to the E word or regard it as a term of abuse.
You've said, Neil, that Americans lack an imperial cast of mind.
Well, that seems to me to be one of the key weaknesses of this empire. I mean, at the heart of my book Colossus is the proposition that it's a dysfunctional empire. And one of the reasons, I think, is that the imperial mentality is absent. The United States embarks on what look like typical imperial projects. Marching into Afghanistan or Mesopotamia is pretty much what empires throughout the ages have done. But the American electorate expects these interventions to be over and done with within maximum 4 years. And people get pretty restive even after year two. That's a problem because you can't actually turn a conquered country into something vaguely resembling your own system in such a tight time frame. An empire should anticipate occupations that last decades, if not centuries. And that's something that the United States finds extremely difficult to do. Incidentally, it also implies that some Americans have to spend a large part of their lives in these hot, poor countries. I remember once saying to a friend in New York at the time of the invasion of Iraq that the problem with Americans is that they didn't want to spend enough of their time in hot, poor countries. And he said, "You're absolutely right. I really don't even want to go to Alabama."
It does interfere with one's quality of life, which is rather key around here, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the differences between the British Empire and the American Empire is that there were very substantial numbers of poor Celts, the Scots and the Irish were disproportionately involved in this, who were ready to emigrate and try their luck. Now, there isn't an obvious social group that has an incentive to emigrate from the United States. On the contrary, many of the people who end up in the American Armed Services have often come here consciously as immigrants or are the children of relatively recent immigrants. That's a fundamental structural problem. It's hard to run an overseas empire if nobody wants actually to go there. If you don't have people who are actually ready to go and spend years of their lives in these places and learn the languages and get familiar with the population, then it's very difficult indeed. I mean, 6 month tour of duty is not enough. Certainly not enough to learn Arabic.
Well, let me go back to my question then. If we're not acting like an empire, how can we be an empire?
Well, it's quite possible that the United States simply can't be a better empire, that it is and will always be this kind of an empire, unless there's a really profound increase in the sense of vulnerability that Americans currently have. It's not clear to me what the consequences would be of another major terrorist attack, particularly a nuclear terrorist attack. That might shift attitudes.
Neil, how do you define the word empire, and what do you think is its connotation or implication?
Well, I'm a historian, not a dictionary, and I tend to define things in terms of what we've seen in the past. There have been about 70 entities that other historians have called empires throughout history. The common factor is that an empire consists of the imposition of power on foreign peoples over a relatively protracted time frame, and the imposition of power can take a whole range of different forms, but the critical common factor is the imposition of power beyond the borders of one people on other peoples.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm speaking with the Harvard historian Neil Ferguson. Neil, in your book Colossus, you write that, quote, many parts of the world would benefit from a period of American rule. That sounds pretty hands-on. I mean, what do you have in mind in terms of Iraq? Should we colonize it?
Well, the United States, in effect, has ruled Iraq since 2003. And although we have a superficial transition to Iraqi self-rule post the elections, creation of an Iraqi government, security is still fundamentally the responsibility of the United States. And Iraqi forces are fundamentally trained and organized by the United States. So to some degree, Iraq is already an American colony. Now, the problem is very simple, actually. Until the United States maintains a significant military presence in Iraq, it will not be able to establish order. You can't do what the British did in Basra, pull out, delegate power to the Iraqis, and then step back in amazement as the militias take over. And the next thing you know, you have a civil war in southern Iraq. That's what could happen in the country as a whole if there's an accelerated reduction in the American presence.
Speaking of the British, as you know, Neil, Britain occupied Iraq from 1917 through the mid-1950s, and they were viewed also as conquerors, not liberators, despite their efforts to the contrary. Is this occupation, the British one, an example you want the U.S. to emulate?
It sticks in the throat, I think, for most Americans to say that they could emulate or should emulate the example of the British Empire, least of all in the Middle East. Conventional wisdom says that all the problems of the Middle East were somehow invented by the British, including the state of Iraq itself. But it's worth going back to 1917 and seeing what happened there. The British arrived towards the end of the First World War in what had previously been a part of the Ottoman Empire. In the aftermath of that invasion, the British quite swiftly moved in the direction of Iraqi self-government. They created a government rather in their own image, a constitutional monarchy with a Hashemite king, and they continued to provide that regime with a security force. So there was a military presence in Iraq right the way through to the mid-1950s. And that seems to me, actually, when one looks at it, not to have been a disastrous outcome. If the United States could come close to matching that British experience, achieve roughly 40 years of political and economic stabilization, then that would be a pretty good outcome compared with where we currently are. And bear in mind also that there are strategic dimensions to this. Yes, of course it would be nice if Iraq could become a prosperous democracy, and that's an admirable and I don't think unattainable goal. But probably the more important thing from the empire's point of view is that it should be a stable and reliable ally in a region of vital strategic importance to the United States.
Neil, you've said in the past that you didn't oppose the invasion of Iraq, and that's a position that you say you've now come to regret. What is it that you regret about the invasion?
Well, I at the time opposed British involvement, but argued that it quite probably was in America's interest to establish a new presence in Iraq and to get rid of Saddam. The mistake I made was that I overestimated the competence of the Bush administration. I had rather casually assumed that a team that included Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, just to name just two of the experienced old hands that George W. Bush appointed, would be capable of executing not just an overthrow of Saddam, but the creation of a stable new regime in the aftermath.
But you were reading the newspapers, Neil. You knew how many troops they were sending over and their desire to leave as soon as possible.
Well, I wrote at the time in the papers, not only reading them but writing for them, that this was extremely risky. And almost all my journalism in 2003, if you go back and look, was highly critical of of this enterprise. Now, the question is whether on the basis of these criticisms I should have performed volte-face is a good question. But at the time, with the knowledge that we had, I, in common with a substantial number of American politicians, including many Democrats, thought that it was the right thing to do. And I don't think the status quo was a particularly attractive scenario at that time.
Is it better than what we have now? The status quo that we had, is it better than what we have now?
Almost certainly. I think one has to acknowledge that the mistakes made after the initial invasion have made Iraq a much more expensive problem for the United States than it was before. But I think the problem is that Americans don't really want to acknowledge that they do have vital strategic interests. There's this sort of fantasy that it doesn't terribly matter, you know, who runs the region of the world, which is, to all intents and purposes, the key to future world energy supplies. It matters hugely, and Americans ought to recognize that.
Neil, let's look at another empire, the Roman Empire. You've written previously that you think the American Empire is in decline. Do you think it mirrors the decline of Rome?
Well, I've always been careful about this because it's not clear that the United States is in irreversible decline. I mean, clearly its power in the Middle East is less at the moment than it was, say, in the mid-1970s. In other respects, it's hard to claim that there's been significant decline. If anything, American economic power has increased since the 1970s. So I think decline is a very, very slippery term, and it's all too easy to say, oh gosh, we are Rome, we're teetering on the brink of dissolution. The United States is in transition, as we were saying earlier, from a Republican cast of mind towards something more like an imperial cast of mind. I suspect that transition would be accelerated if there were another major terrorist attack. In that sense, it's early days.
In an article you wrote for Vanity Fair, Neil, you mentioned that the first sign of Roman imperial overstretch was when it invaded Mesopotamia, which is, of course, present-day Iraq. Sounds a little familiar.
Well, I was having a little bit of fun comparing present-day America with Gibbon's, Edward Gibbon's, declining Rome. But in fact, there's an interesting twist to that tale. The Roman Empire extended into Mesopotamia more than once. In fact, its first foray into what we now call Iraq happened under the Emperor Trajan. And in that moment, you could speak of Roman overstretch. Unquestionably, Trajan was one of these emperors who just pushed the imperial frontier too far. His successor, Hadrian, consolidated it by withdrawing the Roman frontier, taking it back to defensible positions beyond Mesopotamia, and also Hadrian withdrew Roman forces from Scotland, an ungovernable country full of people like me, and built the famous wall to mark the western frontier of the empire. Now, that was not a moment that anticipated Roman decline. It was a consolidation of the Roman Empire, and the empire's great days in many ways lay ahead of it. So I think there is a sense in which the United States could conceivably be in that kind of a situation. The next president could conceivably be a Hadrian who consolidates America's overseas presence, who moves it to a more sustainable frontier, and lays the foundation for a period of economic and imperial prosperity and stability.
Last question, Neil. What do you think is going to happen? You've talked a lot about what you think the U.S. should do. What do you think the U.S. will do?
Well, of course, I'm only a historian. I don't have the power of prophecy. I'm always reminding students that there's no such thing as the future anyway. There are only futures, plural, and it's easy to think of at least two futures where Iraq is concerned. In one future, a president moves to reduce the American presence, wind up the American presence in Iraq, a sort of Nixon-Vietnam type strategy, which turns out to be harder to do than perhaps that president had encouraged the electorate to believe. And so we get into a particularly messy exit in which the US forces become more and more vulnerable as their numbers decline and the level of violence in Iraq escalates, and it all ends up with helicopters removing the last people from the green zone. I mean, that's a plausible future. We've seen that movie before, after all. But there's another, I think, more attractive future in which realism prevails And it's understood that this does not need to be a rerun of Vietnam, that Iraq could be stabilized, but it is going to take years, and it's going to take a sustained and effective military presence that has credibility and isn't simply seen as a temporary expedient. I think that's essentially the choice of futures that the next president will face, and I'm hopeful that he'll choose the latter rather than the repeat scenario which we've seen back in the 1970s.
Neil Ferguson, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Harvard historian Neil Ferguson on ThoughtCast. Please tell us what you think. To leave a comment, go to thoughtcast.org and search for the word empire. I'm Jenny Atiyah. Thanks for joining us.